Hi, I'm Monse, and this is Musings of the Artist, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists.
Aline Smithson is a visual artist, editor, and educator based in Los Angeles. She's also the founder and editor-in-chief of LensScratch, a daily journal on photography. In this conversation, Aline talks about her trajectory to fine art photography, from painter to fashion editor to photographer. We discuss roadblocks and fear, long-term projects, the nuances of rejection, building community in the art world, and much more. If you're feeling a little stuck creatively, then this is definitely the episode for you. Get ready to be inspired. Here's my conversation with the wondrous Aline Smithson. Okay, so oh my gosh, I'm so excited for this conversation. It's been a long time coming. And I normally start with this big question. You know, you are so well known in the photography world, in the art world, and you are a, among other things, you're a artist, photographer, an educator. And I want to ask you this big question of, beyond those things that you do day in, day out, you know, for quote unquote work, how would you start to describe who you are beyond those things?
Oh, gosh. It really always boils down as to being a mother and a wife and a friend and a sister and a daughter and being someone who is just engaged in the world and believes in our humanity. It's, you know, it's interesting to have to describe yourself, but I think I'm just an open and joyous person, and I really enjoy people, and I mostly enjoy my family. I learn so much from my children, and they fulfill me in a profound way. So I don't know if that is a good answer.
It's a great answer. And you know, the question is like, of course, it's always changing, right? We're always in flux, but I love that. And I just love to ask it because, you know, especially with these the kind of interviews and media, you know, we talk so much about the work and we rarely talk about the person, you know?
Right.
So yeah, that's great. And I mean, I think also your family and who you are is really represented in your work, which is really cool. I wanted to ask too about, you have such an interesting path to photography. I know you wanted to be a painter, and I think you went to school for painting. Is that right?
I had an art education, so it wasn't just painting. It was printmaking, it was drawing, it was photography. It was, you know, all things that you have access to when you're an art major. And I mean, everything was possible. I was in a band. We created zine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's when I think being in art school is like the best thing ever, because every day you can try something different. And ultimately, I sort of settled on painting quite large abstract oils. And then I moved to New York right after college, but I continued to paint for another 10 years, even though I had a full-time job. I just painted in my apartment, and that career never went anywhere other than the walls of my own home and a few friends. But I loved painting.
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, and you were also a fashion editor, right? And you've done all these things, and your story just is really inspiring to me. And I think, you know, we often hear about, you know, on the outside sort of these artists, we hear about sort of, oh yeah, like, you know, just like what they're doing right now. And, you know, it'll be easy to like look at your career and just, you have this highly successful career in photography, but I love that there is sort of a winding path to it. It wasn't like boom, right? And I love sort of talking about that, those paths and how you got to where you are. And I just want to hear your thoughts about, you know, sort of this discovery about, of your art form and what, just what you think when, because you work and talk to so many artists and, you know, I think, it's not always super obvious to people, like what the art form is that they are meant to do. Like, I think it takes some back to like what we were talking about before we hit record about just sort of the searching of, you know, for the thing. And just, you know, like what do you, I'm babbling on, but I want to ask, like, what do you think about this discovery and what do you sort of advise people when they are a little bit lost on, like, they know that they know they want to be an artist, but they don't know what form that's going to take yet?
Wow. Well, I wanted to back up and say probably one of the most important jobs I've ever had was being a waitress. I waitressed all through college. I waitressed when I first moved to New York. And I really learned a lot about human nature. I learned how to be really organized. I learned to see the macro and the micro. And I took those skills with me when I became a fashion editor, because we would do these shoots in far-flung places around the world, and we would have to pack everything that we would need if we're going to a remote island that, you know, we can't find certain accessories on this island. So I would have to think about the entire shoot down to every detail that went into it. And so I had to think about the micro and the macro. And I think that being a waitress really gave me those skills. Also, when you're working with a group of people and you are really trying to keep everyone enthused and happy and working towards a common goal, that's something also I learned working with people as a waitress. So I think that, you know, sometimes our humblest, the humblest things that we do in life actually are more important than we realize. I think of being in service to someone, dealing with the public, those are all really good skills to have. I come from a background which is really everything I've achieved is just through hard work. You know, nothing was handed to me. And I had many years in New York of feeling incredibly lonely and lost, but just kept trying. And and then ultimately, you know, had this fabulous job that took me all around the world. And then I met my husband, and we ended up moving back to California. I had my daughter. My daughter was born in New York, but then we moved to California. And then again, he went to graduate school, and I was kind of adrift after having this big career, now being home and being a mother and not having any friends and having to start all over again and sort of redefine who I was. I went back to school during the evenings and got a degree in fashion design. I thought I would be a designer. And then the day of graduation, I remember feeling, ooh, this was the wrong decision. This is all about money. This is not necessarily about creativity. And I kind of went into a funk. Like, I had just spent 2 years going to school and it wasn't the right path for me. And so I took a photography class, and that really changed the course of my art making, because I realized I could use a camera to make art. And that was so exciting. And then I just started. And I think I've mentioned to you, the first 5 years or so, I was just anonymous. I was just making work and loving going to the dark room and figuring it out and photographing my kids and friends and neighbors, and then slowly began to sort of understand the trajectory of being a fine art photographer. And, you know, my first time I was ever asked to teach, I was teaching a toy camera class because I had been shooting a lot of toy camera. And I had a terrible fear of public speaking. Like, there's two things I hated in life, and it was snakes and public speaking. And it was so bad that I took a public speaking class at UCLA, and the first class, everyone had to stand up and say their name. And I stood up and said my name and immediately left the classroom and never went back. It was a terrible fear, but I went to my doctor, and there is a medication for people like me. And then when I went to get it filled, it's basically a beta blocker that keeps your heart beating at the same pace. You still are scared, but you're not going to panic. Mm-hmm. And now I still take it on occasion, but I've gotten a lot more comfortable. So, you know, each thing has its, like, you have to grow in each step along the way. And so I think I have rambled on.
That was great. That's so interesting. I would never in a million years have thought you had, you know, the public speaking fear. And that just, first of all, I just think that's such a common thing that, like, most people maybe have that. I think it's like, you know, so anyways, that. And then also, it's interesting, right? Because now you do so much speaking. I mean, you not only do you teach, but you also do a lot of artist talks, and you are always, it's just always such a joy to be, like, be in the audience of those. And I would never have guessed that you struggled with that. So thank you for sharing that, because I think it's really, it helps people to know that you can still be really successful at this thing despite the fear, right?
Yeah, and I think it is like developing a muscle. Like, you know, I still get nervous, but I don't have that crippling fear anymore. But that, you know, that took a while to get
it. It does take a while. You just reminded me of, like, back in when I used to work for Pandora, and I was managing the live sessions, and before the session, it was just our staff, you know, the musicians would come, and I would have to introduce the musicians to about 50 to 100 people. And I was so terrified at the beginning that I would actually write out everything I was going to say about the band, like, down to, like, every word I was going to speak. And then after a couple years, I realized that I wasn't even thinking about it. I didn't write anything down. I just went and, you know, introduced them like it was no big deal.
Yeah.
But it took so long to get from that first place to the other place, you know? So I think that's a natural progression.
Yeah. And I think, you know, oftentimes I still write down what I'm going to say, and then I read it to myself out loud, and then I hear it. And somehow that really helps when I do have to say it. So, you know, little
good
tricks.
Tip. Yeah. Yes. Another thing you were saying in your story that I just wanted to sort of pause on too was this idea, you know, circling back to this idea that you found your way to the thing by sort of process of elimination in a way, right? Because you were describing, you know, after having spent 2 years studying something that you were like, this is actually not what I want to do. And I just, again, think that's really an inspiring thing to talk about, because how often do people just sort of stay and that, like, well, I've spent 2 years doing this thing, I guess this is what I'm going to do. But it takes some sort of bravery in a way, right? To say, actually, no, this is not what I want to do, or even though I spent this 2 years doing this thing. And I think that oftentimes to get to the thing we really are meant to do and that we really love doing, we have to sort of try a bunch of things and it's sort of like deciding, oh, this is not actually the thing. Whoops. Like I know because I've tried it, you know, and that gets you just closer to the thing that you actually are meant to be doing.
Well, our greatest teacher is failure. And yeah. I wouldn't say that failure was something that I would define, you know, having gone to fashion design school, but, you know, it was really beginning to recognize what I needed and who I was. I think, you know, our whole lifetime, we're always trying to define ourselves. And when something doesn't feel right, it's time to change, make a change. So,
yeah.
I just felt really guilty because my husband had babysat the kids for 2 years while I could go off. But, you know, it's okay.
Well, and I'm sure there's things from that time that, you know, whether it's subconscious or conscious, like I'm sure there's things that have, you know, inspired what you do now, you know, and it's, I'm sure that it's not lost.
Well, I'm an excellent sewer.
So there you go. That's
very rarely sew anything anymore. But
Just like also with the waitress thing you were talking about, like that, you know, I think so many artists worked in the service industry prior, and that inspires a lot of their work, you know. So I think it's just sort of a different way of looking at it. Like nothing's really lost. You know, right. It's just, it can all be fed into the art.
Right.
I want to talk to you about this big topic of community in the art world, because you're sort of the queen of community in the photography world. And you've created Lens Scratch, which I'd love to touch on a little bit later. But, you know, there's something, I think it was in your bio or somewhere I read, this line about you. It said, after a decade-long career as a New York fashion editor, Aline returned to Los Angeles and to her own artistic practice. And I was sort of thinking about, you know, in class yesterday, you were talking about also, you know, to kind of go along with this that line, you're talking about this balance, right, of community, that you spend so much time in this space of in service really to other artists. You spend a lot of time as an educator, as a mentor, giving artist talks or interviewing other authors in the world of MFA land and other photographers. And of course with Lens Scratch, you're showcasing other artists all the time. So you put a lot of energy into that, right? But alongside that, you are an artist. So can you talk to me a bit about this, about this balance and sort of how you navigate this? Because, you know, a lot of times you'll see people that are in one camp or the other and not necessarily trying to do both with equal passion, right? So yes. I just want to hear your thoughts about that.
It's a struggle, I have to be honest. The thing that suffers the most is my art making, and I've been thinking a lot about how I can shift things so that I have more time for myself. But when I started out, I was, as I said, I worked in isolation, and I really, really wanted to have a community in Los Angeles, especially. And when I started teaching, I never let anybody go. Like, I'd continue to send them things I'd come across, and then often my classes, I had a class called Next Step 1, and then everyone wanted Next Step 2, and then there was Next Step 3. And then they wanted to take Next Step 3 again and again. And, you know, some students I had for years. And then I would teach more classes. But we all were connected. And I really shared my philosophy of that we have to support each other. And not everyone is going to have success at the same time. And if you are supporting someone who's having a show or got into something, this is even on Facebook or Instagram, when you have that, it'll come back to you. and everyone will be supporting you. And so that was kind of my philosophy. And we do have a really strong photography community in Los Angeles that I'm so happy to be a part of. And I think, you know, Facebook has created a community. As much as I hate Facebook, I did find over the pandemic that it was a place to connect with photographers all over the world and, you know, share our thoughts and our images. I do feel there's an abundance of people having successes and sharing them on all of these sites. And after a while, it does get a little, you're just constantly saying, great job, congrats. And I have to say, I, you know, post my successes too. So I am, you know, at fault in this too. But I think this journey is just so much richer with other people. And, but getting back to like doing all these things, I think I may need to eventually push back on the teaching and then just be an artist and maybe do lens scratch. There are definitely times I'm ready to shut that project down, but there's no perfect solution or way to balance it all. You know, I do put X's through days on my calendar so that I have a day just for art making or even just simply going through my archives and looking at work. I mean, it's like seeing old friends. So all do that.
No, I love that idea of like putting X's through the calendar too, just to reserve that time. And I wondered, like, do you, when you are working on a project, and I mean, I'm sure you're always sort of working on a project, but when you have something that really does need your focus, do you purposely sort of say, okay, for these X amount of months, I'm just not going to schedule myself in classes, or, you know, do you do that? Or is that?
Did that this summer. I tried not to teach from the middle of June through the middle of September. But I unfortunately got COVID this summer, breakthrough COVID, and that took at least 6 weeks to fully recover from. I wasn't that sick, but yeah. I just didn't have a lot of energy. So I didn't get to make all the work that I had hoped to make. But what I'm hoping to do is carve out more, you know, my summers and have them just for me and my art.
Oh yeah. And that's really nice to have that sort of seasonal thing where it's like, okay, this during the season, it's about my work.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And so we touched on lens scratch, and I know you talk about this, probably have to talk about it all the time, but I would love to, just for people listening that are not already familiar with lens scratch. I mean, it's going to feel like they just got, you know, Christmas came early. So if they're a photographer, so I would love to, can you just tell us about that a little bit, about the genesis of it? Great.
In 2007, everyone started a personal blog on their website. It seemed like everyone did.
Yeah.
And it was like a whole new terrain to explore, you know, as a writer. You may have been producing content on a blog back then. I don't know. But so I started my own blog that was just about my work. And about every 3 or 4 days, I would post a new photo. And I literally had maybe 5 followers. And I would wait for the 5 followers to give me the thumbs up and you know, acknowledge what I have posted. And after about 6 months, I thought, this is so hollow. This is so ridiculous. I don't really need the validation from my friends. I need to use this platform differently. So I was teaching and I was thinking, you know, I could really use, I could create a space for me personally to learn about other photographers and have my students also learn. And so initially, I came up with a name, and then I would just go on people's websites and pull work off and write something. And I never contacted the photographer because I hadn't asked permission, but I was just basically sharing this with my students. And then after a while, I realized that I really should be communicating with the photographer and reaching out and asking for better files and a bio and a statement and having some kind of conversation. And so, so I did that, and I made a vow stupidly to myself that I would write every day. And so for about the first 8 years or so, I did that. And then some of my students came on and helped me. I have two former students who work on the back end of Lens Scratch, and I have other people that help with social media. And then I've had guest editors. And then 2 years ago, I brought on about 10 new editors to sort of take the burden of writing off of me. And we decided to try to do themed weeks so that an educator could use that whole week of posts in a lecture to talk about sort of that theme in photography. So that was kind of a new thing that we're continuing to do. We're always trying to think, what would people be interested in reading about? So in December, we're going to interview publishers. And from the perspective as of a photographer who is kind of looking to get their book published. And I'm hoping we have about 20 publishers that we're gonna interview and learn from. And I don't think that's been done in that quantity anywhere online. So I'm hoping that becomes a really good resource for photographers. And then we also want to do some posts on sequencing photographs and book binding and papers and all the details that you have to learn. Because when you finally publish your first book, it is daunting. It's a huge learning curve that you have to go through. So things like that. And then we have awards programs. We have our annual Lens Scratch Student Prize Award, which we have a lot of sponsors. And this year, Fuji jumped in and gave us money and gave cameras to all of the winners. And that was fantastic. We also have exhibitions every couple of months that are free to submit to. So I really see the site as a community and a resource.
Yeah, it's such an incredible gift, and it's free for people. It's like there's no paywall.
We have no barrier for entry because it's free, because we all work for free.
Right.
For 15 years, I've never taken a penny from the site.
It's such a gift. It's such a gift to the community. And I mean, even one of the things that I love about it is when I get really inspired for like a project idea, like for example, I was talking to you about the wanting to use my old family photos and in a certain project, and you have like a whole, when you go to Lens Scratch, you can sort by topic, and so there's like a whole section on family photos or something like that. But I love that. You know, it's just such a source of it's great for research, you know?
I do think a lot of educators, use it in their classroom and assign students things to research on the site. So, I'm very happy about that.
Yeah. And on the topic of research, actually, I just thought to ask you this because, you know, before we hit record, I was talking to you about a project idea, and you were telling me about some other some photographers who have done sort of some work in that vein. And just thinking about this lately a lot, I don't know why I've been sort of obsessed with this thought about lately, and maybe because I'm making so much new work, especially in writing. And, you know, I'll a light bulb will go off and I'll think of this idea and I get really excited about it and I'll start making the work. And then like 2 days later, I'll see something pop up about this book that is exactly what I was just thinking about doing, you know? And I sort of, my sort of default reaction to that is, well, one is excited that I can't wait to see what this person has done and read the book or follow the project. But then the second reaction is, oh, maybe I shouldn't do it then because it's already been done. And I was telling this to my writing mentor advisor, and she, you know, sort of reassured me and said, everything's been done. Like, you know, you can't, yeah. No matter what you do, like, or want to do, everything has been done. So you can't let that stop you because it's like, you know, we're not going to not do this project. I'm not going to write and, because I've been doing a lot of writing in vignettes and segmented work. And she's like, you know, that's been done tons and tons of times, you know, and it's like, you can't not do it because it's been done. So anyways, I'm babbling. The question within this babble is sort of, what are your thoughts about this? Because I know, I mean, you especially, you see so many photographers, and in class, you know, you'll show us so many variations of an idea. And what are your thoughts around this? And what do you tell people like me who sort of get paralyzed sometimes when they are excited about a project or embarking on something and then they see that it's already been done? Like, what would you say to someone like me in that regard?
Well, I mean, if you think about it from a curatorial perspective, curators are often looking for work that is produced under the same theme. So when you look at an exhibition, it might be on, let's just say technology or something. And then they look for all these different projects, different approaches, different work about projects, about technology. So I never think it's a bad thing when there's someone who is sort of at making work in the same, around the same idea, because mm-hmm. it kind of means it's in the zeitgeist. And that it could be an amazing group show. People always kind of like, oh no, someone else is doing that. But I think actually that's a good thing, because it actually means that more than one person is thinking about this idea. And for a curator, putting those projects together could make for a really interesting show. And that's one thing I always say in my classes. Is there someone who's making work that is in a similar, with around a similar idea? And could you approach them and put together a group show?
Yeah. I love that. And just encouraging that sort of community right there.
Right. For instance, I reviewed the work of a woman who was doing these really fantastic photographs of an old dollhouse. And then I knew, and I have also have a project about paper dolls. And then I knew another woman who does an amazing project using miniatures and often sort of dollhouse dolls. And I thought this would be a really interesting exhibition to put all of our projects together as women of a certain age who are looking back at our childhood playthings and making art out of them.
Yes.
So, you know, I think we just have to sort of shift the way we think. Though I have to say, maybe 10 years ago, I did a project when I was in Europe, particularly in Paris and Rome, of people looking at famous paintings really through the backs of their cell phone. They were so busy trying to take a picture of the painting, they weren't actually seeing the painting. And so I came home and I had all these photos of people with their cell phones in front of paintings and was really excited about it. And I started researching it and I found three projects that were exactly the same. I mean, we could have all mixed and matched our work. And the work was already out there for the other people. And, you know, so I never put that work out. I just let it die.
Oh, interesting.
But, you know, it wasn't like a profound series either.
Right.
That's why I always think the more personal your projects are, the less likely someone has got an exact replica of it.
That is such a good little note to add because, wow, yeah, you were talking about in class yesterday, back to the whole family, you know, sort of doing the photography, making projects like of things that are under your roof because, yes, lots of people will take pictures or make projects about their kids or their grandparents or whatever, but no one's going to do it the way you do it. So
right.
That's the key thing. It's funny because as you're talking about this, it's making me think, because I was sort of like, well, why is it that I have this sort of thing inside of me that's like, oh, someone else has done it, then I shouldn't do it, right? And so why is that? And I was just thinking that when I first started writing and I was taking my first writing class, the teacher, I remember one of the first things she advised us was, this is a personal essay class, and she said, Google to see who else has done it, and if it's already been done, then move on. So I think I have that sort of stamp in me that's like, oh, okay, then I shouldn't touch things that have already been done, even if I'm really excited about it. But that's just, I don't agree with that anymore. You know, I don't think it's just what you said about maybe the reason you had to, or not had to, but you decided to abandon that project was because it was something that you were doing a project outside of yourself, right? And it was
right.
Something, whereas if you're doing like a project about your daughter, you know, you're not going to say, oh, I'm not going to do a project about my daughter because other people have done projects about their daughters, you know, because
right.
It's going to be
exactly.
Very unique to yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, this was enlightening. Thank you for talking about that. it's a good discussion to have. Let's see. I wanted to ask you also about, so I was just sort of thinking, and I told you this at the top of our conversation today before we hit record, about how much your class really, I mean, you just really energized me as a teacher, as a mentor. And I was telling you how I've been feeling a little bit sort of blah these last couple of months and just sort of lower energy about my work. And I, especially with photography, taking, you know, being back in your class yesterday, I was just like, all of a sudden, it was like the Christmas tree, all the lights went on, and I just started being so excited again, and to make work, and have all these ideas, and it was just what I needed. And my question is, I want to ask you about, you know, you do that, you give that gift to so many people, your students. I know that I'm far from alone in that feeling when, you know, a part of your class. And I'm just curious about like what you do, what you turn to when you're feeling in sort of a, like a creative rut.
You know, I have to say that the journey of an artist or a human being has its highs and lows, that you're not always creative. You're not always creatively thinking. You're not always making work. There are definitely down periods. You know, I mean, one thing I love to do is watch TV. I have never been embarrassed by it. I just, I have, and I watch a lot of, you know, really terrible TV. I always get very invigorated when I go to an art museum and look at paintings. I don't get as invigorated for me necessarily looking at photographs. And I look at hundreds of photographs, probably thousands each week, because I'm, you know, editing or I'm during a show or doing something. And I get excited by the work, but it doesn't necessarily mean I'm excited that it will make my photographs different. I've never been necessarily influenced by the work that I share of other people's work. I think all my influences really come from the stew of my childhood, the things that I'm drawn to, I took a wonderful class during COVID on text and image with Joanne Dugan. That got me writing. It got me realizing I could create some small projects about very simple things. I created a project about all the things on my bulletin board, which sounds, but I really thought about that that would be a gift for my children because they don't know what I look at all day long and what things are meaningful to me. And to put that in a little book could be, sometimes creating something doesn't have to be for a big audience. It could be just for yourself, or it could be for your family, or it could be a gift to a friend. And I think we all, worry that we need to do everything on a grand scale. But I think, and I'm kind of going off topic, but I really did a lot of soul searching during the pandemic about what was important to me. And of course, we would all want a solo show at the Museum of Modern Art. But what's really important to me is that my children understand who I am so that they can share that with their children. And, I wanted something to move into the future in a more personal way.
Yeah, I love all of that. I think it's also a nice reminder to that we should just make the work that we want to make and worry and think about the audience and later, right? Like if it, like you said, sometimes it'll just be for your children. And who knows, maybe somehow later on you'll be inspired to share it more broadly, but you don't need to figure that out right now.
Right.
Do you have, like, what would you say are the kind of the key ingredients to making a photo successful?
Well, as I was saying yesterday, I think everything is always elevated by light. And I mean using light as part of the process of making a photograph, like looking for shafts of light and looking for a light, how it illuminates whatever it is that you're photographing. As a juror, I'm always looking for something that is elevated, that feels like the person really has committed to that image. They haven't overused sharpening or hue saturation. Every juror is completely different. So defining a successful photograph is so subjective. And I'm, again, probably going a bit off topic, but I thought about this a lot in when I juror things is, I like really simple images. I like a lot of clarity. I like, I can spot images shot on film. There's a quality to the color and the nuances that I'm drawn to. And I have a really good friend who I've been paired with several times to juror an exhibition. And the first time we jurored, I thought, oh, we have such similar sensibilities. This is going to be so easy. And we only had 25% of the images in common. And then we had to sort of fight each other for the rest. And then several years later, we were asked to do it again. And I thought, okay, I know her even better now. It's definitely going to be, like 75. Again, it was 25% in common. And when we were looking at the images, she was like, oh, how did I miss that one that you picked? And I felt the same, like, oh, that's a really good photograph. Why didn't I see that when I was looking at it? And it really makes you realize how subjective looking at a photograph is. I've seen exhibitions where I am like literally scratching my head why the juror picked those images. And then I've seen exhibitions where it's just like everything I love. So I can't really give you a definitive answer because I think it really depends who the viewer is of the photograph.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And it's like, that's what I was curious about, is what it to you is, you know, successful. And I love what you're saying, because it just back to like, we were also talking about earlier about this idea of like rejection and as an artist, you know, having to get used to that and build that muscle. And I think one of the things we all have to remember as artists is that it is so subjective. Like, you know, someone can reject your work and your work could be brilliant, you know, but it's just that person didn't resonate with it. You know, it's not an objective thing.
Well, also what people don't realize, if I'm looking at, I think for a show last year, I had to look at 3,000 images and I had to boil it down to 35. I mean, that's crazy.
Totally.
And I ended up boiling it down to 300. And I really felt that all 300 deserved to be in that show. And then it was just like cutting off limbs as I was like saying goodbye to things that I really believed in and loved. And those photographers had no idea that I was feeling that way about their work. And so oftentimes when you're rejected, it might have been in the mix until the last minute, and then something made the juror cut it. And the other thing I always try to point out is I'm juring an exhibition, so I can't have five images that look similar. So I have to have a varied, interesting exhibition also. But, you know, I also enter my work into things and I get rejected all the time. And now that I've been on the other side, I am not as offended as I have been in the past.
Totally. Yeah.
So you just kind of understand. And one time I was rejected to a show, and then I was at a portfolio review and the reviewer walked by and said, "Oh, I loved this work. I didn't have room to get it in the show." And then like a month later, he reached out to me and gave me a solo show.
So, amazing. What a good story.
You just never know what can happen.
I'm so glad you shared all that, because, I was going to ask you, so have being on the other side, does that help you as an artist to realize, you know, and that's such a important reminder. Because I think, you know, as sensitive artists, we could all often just take it as such a black and white thing, you know, but it's just really not. It's so layered, and there's a lot of those almost yeses, right?
And people that you don't know about. So people take it so personally, they'll think, right, Oh, Aline hates my work because she didn't pick it. But they don't realize there's also 300 images that I'm having to deal with. And yeah, one of my friends who's a photo center director who doesn't pick the work, but she has jurors, you know, that pick the work, but they'll say, "Oh, so-and-so, this photo center director doesn't like my work." Well, she's not the one not picking it. So everyone is trying to assign, you know, a reason for why they weren't, why they didn't get in. It's someone else's fault.
Right. Well, also, does it, I'm curious too, if, you know, being so immersed in this world and having so many friendships with photographers, does that ever get tricky when like you have to reject a friend?
Oh, I just did that. I had to reject two friends from a show. And, you know, one I actually wrote to and said, "I'm sorry, you know, when I juror, I try to put blinders on and look at the work and not think about the people."
So you have to, right?
Yeah. So yeah, it's hard, but you know, we all get rejected.
Yeah, and that's just inevitable. Oh, right. Yeah. And it's inevitable if you get more immersed in the world, you're going to have to reject friends and they're going to reject you in other ways. And it's just part of it. So it's good to remember it's not personal. Great. Well, I have one more question, and then I usually do like a little end of round of your to ask you some of your favorite things at the moment. This big question I have that I ask everybody is, what's an act of kindness that you've received in your life that felt transformative or that had a big impact on you?
Oh, wow. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is that when my mother was dying, I had a friend who was constantly checking in, and her mother had died. And so she had been through it, and she knew what I was going through, where other friends were uncomfortable talking about death. And I really learned a lot from that experience to not back off and be shy about things that people are going through. And I'm sure I have many, many more, but that was the first thing that popped in my head.
That's such a profound one, you know, and it's just, you hear that a lot, you know, people that have really good intentions and hearts, but they just back away when something like that's happened because they don't know what to do. And right. I think, I just love what you just shared. I think that's really, really a good reminder to people to lean in, you know, even if it's uncomfortable.
Right.
That's what you need. Yeah. Okay. So as far as your favorite things right now, what is a favorite book of yours?
Well, I hate to say it, but Pride and Prejudice.
Oh yeah. Good old Jane Austen. It's a good one.
Yeah. You know, I honestly don't have a ton of time to read, but, you know, I like the classics. So,
oh yeah, that's a good one. How about a favorite album or song?
Blue by Joni Mitchell. That just, you know, so resonates with my growing up, and that music is like the soundtrack to a certain part of my life. But I also love Prince. I love Beck. You know, I don't know. I love to dance, and I have to say I love Michael Jackson, but it's a little problematic to say that anymore. And even when I hear the music, I feel a little, I feel sad that I'm not enjoying it in the same way. Mm-hmm. But
that's a whole other topic too. Is like, I'm so curious to investigate. It's sort of like, can we still sort of love the art, like separate from the person, you know, like this whole,
right.
That's a tough one, but, no, that's great. And I love that you said Blue. That's my all time favorite.
I loved Billie Eilish's first album too.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good mix. What's the favorite place of yours?
Anywhere in Italy, Paris, and the south of France. I love New York. But any room where my children are with me.
Oh, you're such a good mom. Also, you're doing a workshop in France, aren't you, soon?
Yes, next summer. And I may be teaching one in Japan, too, next year.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I have to look out for that. Japan is like number one on my list of places I want to go. I've never been.
Yeah, me neither.
Oh, you haven't been either?
No.
Oh, yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Okay, so, and lastly, how about one of your favorite memories?
Hmm. I hate to keep bringing up my children. I think it's just sitting at the dinner table and just, well, okay. So one really wonderful memory is that I went with my best friend and her children, who are both my godchildren, and her husband, and my kids and my husband. And we all went to Portofino and that area of Italy. And we were renting a house together. And we went out to dinner one night and we all got really drunk, all the kids, everyone. And I was laughing so hard that I couldn't even get the food down. My stomach hurt the next day. It was just one of those incredibly amazing nights where you just are filled with joy and love and warmth and laughter. And it's just a wonderful memory for me. Yeah. And then of course, no one spoke English. So, you know, just trying to communicate and when we're drunk.
Oh man. Well, thank you so, so much, Aline, for not just this conversation, just for being who you are. And I'm just so grateful for you. And yeah, thank you.
Oh, my great pleasure. And I think you're just an amazing human being, and I'm so happy to have you in my life. And I'm really appreciative that you gave me this opportunity to chat with you, and I hope your listeners enjoy it.
Thank you so, so much. And I'm excited that I get to see you again next week, at least on Zoom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, big hug. And yeah, I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Sounds good.
Bye.
Bye.
Musings of the Artist is audio produced by Aaron Mooring, and theme music is by Madison Ward.